And who did this part?
Little bit of Jill Sobule there, appropriate for our first guest this afternoon. Former sports writer of the year from every organization that awards those kind of things, a longtime columnist for Sports Illustrated, NBC Sports, senior columnist with The Athletic, author of a number of terrific books, including The Soul of Baseball, Paterno, The Secret of Golf, and the proud father of two daughters who maybe have had enough Harry Houdini talked for a while, the author of a terrific new book, The Life and Afterlife of Harry Houdini. Joe Posnansky joins us. Joe, good to have you back with us.
Thank you, Rich. It's great to be back.
And, oh man, I love this book so much. It took me forever to read it because I just wanted to slow down and enjoy it. It's really a terrific piece of history and Americana, and I loved every minute of it.
Thank you. That means a lot to me. This was a pretty big step out from where I normally go, and it was something that means the world to me. And you know, today is launch day, so I'm just taking it all in. It's pretty fun.
Well, you have written primarily about sports, but in many ways, as you point out, Harry Houdini was, in some sense, well, he was an athlete, first of all, a very good athlete, but also about as ruthless as a competitor as you'd ever meet in the sports world.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that he's more, say, Michael Jordan than a classic magician. I mean, he was someone who absolutely had been, and that was the driving force behind his act. I mean, his act was, you come with your handcuffs or your boxes or bags or whatever it is that you want to bring and lock me in there, and I'll get out, and I'll always get out, and I'll always win, and that was... that was his mentality, and he was a good athlete. You know, he was a runner and a boxer and a swimmer, and I do wonder if Houdini was today, you know, in playing today, living today, if he would have been an athlete, because you know that seems to be the thing that drove him. But you know, as it turns out, it was for him. It was this idea of escape and this idea of magic, and wow, it's 100 years later, and we're still talking about the guy.
Well, yeah, and of course, we heard the Jill Sobule song at the beginning. As you point out early in the book, everybody knows him. There have been better magicians, certainly, but no one's talking about most of those people. But 100 years, almost 100 years after his death, there's nobody alive that doesn't know the name, and references to him are constantly being made.
They are constant. You know, and we see him in sports, obviously, a lot, right? We see pitchers who get out of jams being called Houdini, or quarterbacks getting out of sacks that are called Houdini, or basketball players who make some particularly, you know, ridiculous pass. But he is everywhere. I mean, you know, you mentioned the song. There are a stunning number of songs that reference Houdini or about Houdini, television shows, movies. He's everywhere you turn, and you're right. It's so interesting to me that everybody knows him, you know, and that includes if you go into a second grade class and say Houdini, even by then, at some point, they've all learned at least a little bit about who this person was. And, you know, it was, you know, as the book really, I think, goes into, that was his driving ambition all of his life, was to become famous beyond anybody else and to be remembered forever. Oh, he did it. I mean, it's you know, it might be his greatest illusion was creating this character that seems to be immortal.
Well, along with his physical ability, I mean, he was had incredible ability as a promoter, as a self-promoter, and especially a knack for getting press or getting reporters to tell the story his way, even before he really became famous. Where did that ability sort of generate?
I think it's just sort of a natural kind of bit of genius that he had. He had a very modern sense of publicity. I mean, even now, people are in awe of the way that he was able to get his story out, because, you know, obviously this was long before any kind of mass communication. And, you know, he was on the very forefront of movies, but I mean, this was before radio, obviously well before television, and And, you know, he created this buzz about himself everywhere he went, and he worked very hard at it. I mean, you know, to think now that in order to get people to come to your show, you would hang upside down in a straitjacket and escape in the middle of town. I mean, that's a pretty heavy price to pay just to sell a few tickets. But that's how he thought, and it's, you know, I think that's where he, there are many, many ways that he connects to today, but I think people use the Houdini methods of promotion today more than they certainly did in his time. And the idea of the way he not only, worked with the press, but the way he manipulated the press, the way he created myths for himself and had them, you know, appear true and all of those things that I think we can all recognize in our day-to-day lives now. That was kind of new when he did it. And I, you know, a lot of people, I think, have followed his path.
We're talking with Joe Posnanski here on Downtown. You, like a lot of people, got hooked on Houdini because of the Tony Curtis movie, which seems so beautifully appropriate because almost none of it was factual, and yet it still captured the essence.
Yeah. I mean, in so many ways, it's like there's this character, Houdini, that is bigger than life, and you can tell all kinds of Houdini stories that aren't true, but lead to some level of truth. And you know, the Tony Curtis story was, you know, I saw it. So it was a big movie when it came out. I mean, Tony Curtis was a young actor. His wife was in it. I mean, it was like a big production at the time in the 50s. And then it had like this whole renaissance in the 70s. It was on television quite a bit, and a whole bunch of people saw it then. And that movie, you know, kind of kept him going for about 30 years before other people came and picked it up. And now, of course, there are all kinds of documentaries and movies and miniseries. And you know, it seems like every other day there's some new thing, a play or something that is about Harry Houdini. But that movie had a huge impact. I was surprised how many people I talked to in the book who said somehow that movie inspired them to you know, start being interested in the guy.
Your research is outstanding in this book, and Houdini is the centerpiece, but there are so many incredible characters that we meet along the way, and I think the one that I'm most fascinated with is Patrick Culliton. Can you talk a little bit about him?
Yeah. Patrick is an old actor. He played in quite a few TV shows and a couple of movies. And was fascinated by Houdini all of his life, and he went through a rough patch. You know, he went to Vietnam, and he went through a rough patch, and came back and found this second life as somebody who went around the country and told Houdini's story and did some of Houdini's illusions and created this whole character that he called Houdini's ghost. And I was so fascinated by him and fascinated by his story. And you know, part of the book is me sort of chasing him a little bit, trying to find him and get him to talk to me and so I can understand. And the book ends, with him. And it's a bittersweet story and one that I really was very, very moved by him and moved by his story, and I wanted to tell it as well as I could. So he's a fascinating character.
One of the really interesting aspects of the Houdini file is the film that he was very proud of that not many people of our generation have seen, but you got to see The Grim Game.
Yes. There's a whole wonderful story. It's a silent movie that he made that was destroyed essentially for a couple of reasons. You know, most of those movies were destroyed, but his in particular, there was a fire and you know, all of his movies were lost, and there were only, you know, nobody even knows how many, maybe three remaining copies, and then there were two and then there was one and nobody knew where it was. And it's a wonderful and fun story how that actually came to life, and you know, finding the sole remaining copy and having it redone and remastered and all of that. And then I got to see it, and it's I think as close as we'll get to seeing what made Houdini special. You know, I mean, it's still a funny kind of goofy, you know, the plot is ridiculous and you know, the music that they found for it is, you know, it'll play in your head for a few days afterward and all of that. But the escapes and the things that he does in it, and you can see, and it's all live, you know, he's doing it, I think, on First Take and all of that. I mean, it's pretty stunning, and you could see, like, wow, there is like a charisma about the way he does these things that you could imagine people just being thrilled to go to the theater and to see him do them.
Is the mirror cuffs, that I love that story, the way you break it down, the people who weigh in on it, is that sort of the ultimate Houdini story, because it captures everything, the self-promotion and the subterfuge that was such a part of his story?
Yeah, I fell in love with the story. And to be honest, when I started writing the book, I was unaware of it entirely. And, you know, it's basically the story of him in London. And the paper, the London Mirror, that's why they're called the Mirror Cuffs, challenged him to escape from these perfect handcuffs that were impossible to pick. And there's a whole story that goes along with it, and then him refusing and then accepting and going on stage and it being an hour-long, you know, task and all of these things. But the thing that really got me interested in it was I was talking to some Houdini people early on, and I said, is there any Houdini escape that we still don't know how he did it? Like, I mean, there are a lot of them that the secret is, you know, only a few people know, and you know, you have to actually really go out there and try to find it. But most of them, if you're really eager to know exactly how Houdini got out of things, there are sources. And it turns out that the mirror cuffs, nobody knows. Like everybody has theories, everybody has opinions, and one of those opinions is probably right, but nobody knows for sure how he did it. And I just thought, there's my story right there. There's the story that 100-plus years later, we still don't know. This is one secret that he carried with him to the grave that we'll never know. And I just thought, yeah, that and as you said, it has everything. It's such a wonderful story.
It has everything. It especially speaks to Houdini's charisma because, as you mentioned, it is an hour-long performance, the vast majority of that behind a tent that they
exactly
that
right.
People in the audience weren't able to see him working the escape.
That's exactly right. I mean, it's if we thought of it the way it is now, like if we thought of this kind of performance in today's world, it would be, you know, hey, I'm going to get out of these cuffs, and then he'd go back, and then he'd come out with them still on, and then he'd go back, and then he'd come out, and they're still on, and then he'd go back. And this happens, you know, multiple times, and then he comes out, and he's free. And you know, and people went crazy and carried him on his shoulders, and you know, it was the talk of London for you know, so long. And it speaks to what a different time it was, but I think you're right. It also speaks to working with what he had, his ability to capture the imagination and inspire wonder and awe is unmatched. I mean, you know, he wasn't, by many accounts, he wasn't a great magician, but by all accounts, he was an incredible performer. He was an incredible person at building, you know, these things up into these enormous achievements. And so I love that story. I just love the mirror cuffs, and I spend a lot of time on it. There's a whole section on the mirror cuffs with multiple chapters, multiple theories, and I love that part. It was really a lot of fun.
How important was his wife in the image that we have of Harry Houdini today?
I think the singular most important figure in you know, post Houdini's death, nobody worked harder or more effectively than Bess Houdini in keeping his name alive, in inspiring, you know, these new legends about him. I mean, to the point where, you know, the movie, the Tony Curtis movie that we mentioned, it came out after Bess had died, but Bess was the one that you know, got that movie made. I mean, it was based on her sort of retelling of his life, and you know, she was a great showman herself. You know, she was someone who you know, she was in his act at different times. Certainly at the beginning, she was a very important part of his act. But she, you know, she loved her myths too, and loved telling stories. And they were one. You know, they were a team when it came to those sorts of things. And there's no question in my mind that if Bess had in his passing, if Bess had decided to move on and sort of leave that life behind, that you know, we might know of Harry Houdini, but he would not be the figure that he is today.
You ask yourself the question in the book, do I like Houdini? You say it's complicated. So I ask you this, after the research in the book, do you feel like you know Houdini now?
Oh, I don't know that you ever fully know him. I mean, you know, I think there were parts of himself that he, you know, he was such a public figure, and there's more Houdini memorabilia in the world than just about any celebrity or star, maybe in American history, just because he was constantly out there pushing his name, signing anything that would be signed, and creating, you know, these new fans everywhere he went. And yet there were, you know, he kept secrets, and there were things that you know, it's hard to know. I mean, it's very hard to know what it is that motivated him at the end, you know, particularly at the end after he became famous. So why he was never able to let go of sort of this fury that he had in him. And so I think there are certainly ways I think I understand that. Here's what I would say. There are many people today who, you know, in all walks of life, that whether, you know, they're celebrities or politicians or athletes or whatever the case may be, where they'll do something and I'll think that's a Houdini thing. That feels like Houdini, you know, that you feel like that the way that they promoted this or the way that they pushed themselves or the way they kind of created a myth for themselves or whatever the case may be. So I think that in that way, I think about, you know, his personality and the way he was wired, and I think I understand that.
What's your favorite piece of Houdini memorabilia that you own?
Well, I bought a lot, as I mentioned in the book. I bought a lot of Houdini stuff to the point where my daughters, as you kindly referenced in the beginning, grew a little sick of the whole thing. But I didn't buy anything that is like I didn't buy anything rare. I didn't spend, you know, exorbitant amounts of money. I mean, it was mostly posters and books, of course. I bought all of the books, and you know, I have a first edition of his of the first biography of his, which I think, you know, was you know, written by Harold Kelleck, and it's cool, and I'm glad to own that. But yeah, for me, it's like I like the goofy stuff. You know, I got a Houdini beer mug, and I got a Houdini Pez dispenser, and a Houdini teddy bear, and a Houdini action figure. So I like that kind of stuff. I like the cool, weird Houdini stuff that has been on the market at some point in the last 50 years.
The Life and Afterlife of Harry Houdini, out today, available everywhere you get great books. And Joe, I loved every minute of it. It's such a wonderful tale, wonderfully researched, and as always, brilliantly written. Thank you so much for being with us, and we wish you much success with the book.
Oh, thank you, Rich. I really appreciate it. I love coming on here.
Thanks again, Joe.
Take care.
That's Joe Posnansky. God, such a great book. We both had a chance to read it, and you won't be able to put it down. You might want to, like I did, slow down because I was enjoying it so very much. You pretty much read the whole thing in one night, right?
I read about three quarters of it last night. Skipped a few chapters when it was just getting so late that I said, okay, I want to read the ending. So I skipped maybe a half dozen chapters towards the end. But yeah, absolutely. And now, unfortunately, also a byproduct of reading the book, I want to know a lot more about the Miss Matilda Cornstalk automaton.
Yes, oh yes.
There's so many little things in the book. Yeah, the Buster Keaton story.
Yes, apparently he's responsible for Buster Keaton's name.
Yes, he was working with Buster Keaton's parents.
Yeah,
at a vaudeville show. Yeah.
And little Keaton would break through walls and fall down the stairs. Yes. And he would say, oh, I was a real buster. Boom, my name is born. Well, again, get it. You'll love it. The Life and Afterlife of Harry Houdini.